we're back here again. I think Honourable Tiako must just simply be around, but we really need to start, and we are starting, thinking who else is missing besides herself. Where is the Honourable MacPherson? Because he told me he would be here. Yes, he's on his way as well. But we really can't afford to go back, not for either of them, unfortunately. So perhaps they will turn up pretty soon. But in the meantime, we had just given the Department of Arts and Agriculture the opportunity to make their input, etc. But what I'm going to ask is that we should immediately continue with where you were, DDG, do you recall that? And we were on, I imagine that is the right approach here. I'm looking at everyone. So that then takes us back to the documents. This really, as you can see, Mr. Medema, in deliberating on bills, it's not the most constructive venue. Right. We were actively looking at the pages here. We had looked at the issue of fair use and fair deal. There were certain issues raised by the Department of Arts and Arts and Culture on in their view, the New Deal would have protected the rights of the authors or originators more effectively. And perhaps from the position of the committee, what I must share with Arts and Culture is this. This is not an ANC view now, this is the committee position that I'm putting on the table. And the opposition parties may, if I have misrepresented the fact, correct them. But where we are now is that we were given a bill, the principal act in any case, which is based on fair deal. I'm also looking at the department as I speak to see when they do this to me. And the bill came here not in the best crafted position to move forward from. So the position of the committee was that we would recraft a lot in the bill. And after a workshop in which we had people who spoke for and against each approach, for and against fair use, for and against fair deal, there was a slight reference to a hybrid approach. And as we were going through this and looking at ways to protect the rights of the originators, people such as the person who wrote a song, a musician who composed a piece of music, a writer, and so on and so forth, would these be protected when their works, if you like, went into the realm of education, went into the realm of a library, a museum, and so on, would they still have some protection? Because when the bill was first put to Parliament and to the committee, it was because royalties had not been effectively paid out, in particular to the most vulnerable members of our community and the majority of the population. In short, black Africans. So we had to address that in mind, that we no longer wanted this to continue. And we learned and found out that many of our own institutions, the SABC, I think, is broadly, I know government has over 50% share in that organisation, but it's generally seen as a government, you know, vehicle, as it were. It too had not been paying out royalties. They're acting very much like some irresponsible state-owned companies. So governments weren't doing this for government. The public sector in other areas wasn't doing it. Civil society wasn't doing it, and neither was the private sector. And I don't want to point a finger at who was the biggest abuser here. So it was that which guided us towards saying, how do we protect? Just that's my note to indicate it's 2:45 for the debate, if we were having one. But the other factor was that, what did we have to protect? I've just said the rights of the originator. We had to also ensure that South Africa would not be left behind in the 21st century. And one of our weakest points as a country is the lack of funding for research and development, and one could argue the lack of funding for innovation. And the only way that this country will grow its economy, will grow and protect the works of our arts and our culture and protect it, is to ensure we took account of the 21st century. So we, with all this in mind, the subcommittee, and that's why I did want the Honourable Tiako here, because she chairs the subcommittee, was tasked was taking us through to a particular point where we would have a bill to present to the main committee on trade and industry. And the bill then came here and broadly supported the view from the subcommittee of a hybrid approach. And the only thing that worried us was, would we be able to effectively ensure that we protected the rights that we intended to protect? And that is what has kept us going on the bill so long. If we had simply tinkered around with the main or principal act, we would probably be completed now. But we decided to go for a more open approach here. We were also reassured by various legal advisers, not only the member of the advocate, Van der Merwe, who is, you know, assigned to us, but others, to say that, in fact, there was more serious litigation around Fair Deal than there was with Fair Use. Now, I can't speak from personal experience. I'm speaking from the opinions we have received. And I would be the first to say we have so many lawyers purely because we're always seeking different opinions. But that is the state of play here now, that the committee as a group, all members of the committee, including the opposition, with slightly different views, are moving towards the hybrid approach in terms of fair use and fair dealing. We're neither taking everything from fair dealing, nor are we taking everything from fair use. But we are trying to ensure we have a more open system while protecting, ensuring that these rights are protected of the vulnerable. So we certainly do want arts and culture to continue to just make their point of view known on a particular clause as it comes up, so that we try and deal together with the issue and reach a crafting or phrasing of the clause that the Trade and Industry Committee believes does do what we want it to do, and the Arts and Culture believes that, yes, the concerns they have are addressed. So I look at members now, because if I have somehow misrepresented them, they have the opportunity to say so and correct what I have said. Honourable Kacharya?
Chair, not so much about misrepresenting, but just to explain the position that I hold, is that personally, it's clear, fall on the fair use side of things, but have accepted within the committee the via media, which is a hybrid situation. And as a result of that, we asked DTI to come back, and they came back with the Singaporean example, which seems to be the quintessential example of a working hybrid solution, which comes from a similar legal history as ours, and a forward-looking segue into fair use. Two things concern me, which I want to flag. One is that now, if we are proceeding as a consensus committee, if you like, along a hybrid solution based loosely on the Singaporean model, then I'm concerned that in the first instance that we want to move away from the phraseology in that model, which talks about any purpose, and go back to the such as listings, because that's the hybrid which we are following. Now we're detracting from it in a backward-looking manner. Secondly, I'm concerned, I want to flag my concerns about arts and cultures view, because we, if the committee feels they're moving along this hybrid direction, the issues that originally tasked this committee or exercised it in terms of royalties and people suffering is an issue of enforcement. And we're talking about mechanics of enforcement, but enforcement is required. You've got to get people to go there. Now, but the enforcement has to be predicated on fairness of the rights of the owners and of the rights of access, and that's how we're addressing our minds. Now, if I want to dispel any argument on any side about the complexity and the litigatory aspects which will end up in courts and so on, yeah, we have tribunals, we have legal aid, we have legislation, and we have the courts. The lawyers here will attest to the fact that IP and copyright law is immensely and always has been immensely complex and often ends up in the courts. That's not going to end tomorrow. It's going to continue because these are not cut and dry issues. And at the same time, having a list of exceptions means you have to be an expert on the exceptions. So these things will continue. But let us, my plea is, let us listen to the Singaporean example. Let's not detract from it in a way that favors one or the other necessarily. Let us take the spirit of what they intended, if we agree that is the direction as a committee that we wish to go in. And I think we've got there, so there's much consensus here. The devil, of course, is in the detail. We'll have to protect the rights of people in terms of the academic environment. We'll have to put in wordage which says that, you know, are these books available, at what price. All of those things have to be looked at as an example. So there's detail there, but there's an overarching agreement here. So that's what I want to submit. Thank you.
Right. No, thank you, Honourable Kacharya. Do you wish to comment at all, Honourable Becky, Honourable Tiako? We were just ensuring that the DAC, had an understanding as to where our committee was at this point in time.
No, thanks, Chair. I think you have covered my position because I was up and down, so I'm fine.
Thank you, Honourable Tiako. So then, we are going to move. You remember where you were then, DDG, and yes, we are up on page 18 of the slide 18.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you so much, Chair. I just wanted to make a slight request. On the part where we were regarding the hybrid model, I wanted to request that Mrs. Mabaso Mabango just to come in a bit in terms of closing on the hybrid, like what it means, the implications on the bill itself.
Very good. Thank you, Chairperson and Honourable Member and DDG. From what Mr. Kachala said and the Singapore model, the implication is if we say we're moving towards the fair use, which means we have to repeal Section 12 completely and every related section that may refer to Section 12 and introduce fair use. So moving forward in South Africa, we'll never talk of fair dealing, which means the implication is if we repeal Section 12 and introduce fair use, the implication is our legislative framework will never talk of fair dealing. We will talk of fair use. As long as we understand this, that if we take that approach, it means that.
Thank you, Chair. Let me just clarify what she's saying. If we go to slide 14, we are talking hybrid. We are on the hybrid. It's a hybrid that is, and then we said on the hybrid, we are going to refer to fair use in the hybrid. Hybrid fair use. So what it means practically is that then we replaced the fair dealing that we kept on referring to. Legally what it means is that in the legislation, therefore the fair dealing must be removed. It must be repealed. So we cannot just replace a word. There is that implication of the repeal. So we need to then, just to stick to the hybrid of fair use, we use fair use as a wording instead of fair dealing the way that the Singaporean have done. In Singapore, they retained fair deal and added. We are saying fair use, and then we are going to restrict. So our list is going to come in, but in that fair use, but it's a hybrid. So I just wanted to clarify that. We're still talking about the same thing. It's a hybrid model on fair use, and we are limiting the exceptions, but then the implication, Chair, is that we need to then repeal the fair dealing because you cannot just remove the fair deal. It's already in the Principal Act.
And I will take you, Honourable Tiako. I understood that that was one of the reasons why it would need to be advertised. You know, that's what I understood. But let me come to the Honourable Tiako, who was the chair of the subcommittee. Right.
Chair, it's not about the decision. I'm worried about the department now. Because if Ms. Gregoria is explaining to us, then the DDG has to come in and explain again. So can we check with advocate, please, clarify this uncertainty that the department is bringing now, because it can't be legal experts, both of them, they're talking one thing, different languages, so we need that clear that now before we move.
As you're saying, different tongues, right. But let's just, who is coming in first? Advocate Van der Merwe, and then is it then to be followed? I know, Mashendri, you fall under the DTI, so I'm looking at the DDG. Right. Advocate Van der Merwe, followed by Mashendri. Right.
Thank you, Chairperson and members. The Act only uses the word fair dealing in one section, that is Section 12. The bill on page 16 repeals Section 12. So that has already been done. So if our bill is passed by both houses and becomes enacted, there will be no reference to fair dealing in the Act. So our bill already provides for that. There's also in the bill itself, currently it's only the memorandum and the objects which we have not yet updated to the final bill, and that will happen towards when this committee adopts the bill. That still speaks to fair dealing, but that should come out because our bill no longer speaks to fair dealing at all. It is only fair use that is used in the bill itself. So perhaps the implication or the indication respecting what must be done in the drafting was simply referring to the Act, but our bill already provides for that.
Yes, I'm looking at the principal Act here, just here on my left. It says general exceptions from protection of literary and musical works. And then it indicates that copyright shall not be infringed by any fair dealing with it, as it notes it. But I recall that in our current bill, B bill, that's right, the current one, we also indicate that there's no copyright infringement in these areas. So, you know, to me it is covered, but I am looking at the colleagues here. Are we clear then, because we can get Machinery will add to that. Let's get that addition from you, Machinery.
Thank you, Chair, and colleagues. I think Advocate and I are telepathic. She beats me, just like yesterday. But I think just to add, to provide some comfort to the members, that fair dealing that's coming out of the Principal Act, as I mentioned to you earlier on page 17 of the current bill, the 12B, it's where we've taken those factors and we've modernized it and adapted it for the South African situation now in the 21st century. We've modernized that list. So you'll see the same things are there, the quotation, the illustration. We brought in for the purposes of teaching, you'll see the green writing there. So, and then again, you have your hybrid because we've now merged those two systems, however, making it more open and flexible.
Yes, this is what I was referring to when I said I can see the similarity here and the fact that it achieves the same thing. But what would be constructive is for us to know as a committee whether DAC has got this current fee bill with them. I don't know. Leva, do you have this bill that we're referring to, the B? Because that clearly is making this clearer to us, but I don't know if you've got a copy.
Chairperson, the bill that we've got is the one that was presented to us on the 14th of last month, and I think what is interesting is that we discussed the hybrid model, and what we have been communicating to the DTI about is the question of expanded fair dealing. And we do not have any clarity on how the hybrid model of the fair use will be applied. I think it will be nice if we have some discussion on this matter further so that we can have a proper understanding. You indicated, Chairperson, that our stakeholders, in particular the content creators, when they initially raised the question of protection with the former president, it was something that we had as government to look into, and they have consistently raised the question of protection, and of which I believe this House would want to look into this matter. But we are at a point where we want to balance the interest of the creators and the users, and of which the proposal that is been put forward of a hybrid model. It's something that we can actually look into, provided that the key stakeholders, the content creators, are being protected.
Well, I believe we're on the same page. I do. But I just indicate that what Ms. Madalani, the researcher, has just given you is a copy of the bill, but we have been making certain changes to ensure that our objective is dealt with, and that is on my page 16. Is that correct here? My page 16A, and it's referring to 12A, because it actually says exactly, almost word for word, what has been stated in the other 12, but then it lists more exceptions to it to bring it up to date. So what I would like is to continue, but knowing that when there's a serious reason, it's all dealing now with this issue, that you will just raise your hand, Mr. Mabiba. So don't feel shy, and Ms. Madalani will surely see your hand if I don't. All right. So members, are you going to take us forward then, DDG?
Thank you, Chair. Clause 22, Section 21 is on the commissioned work. One of the areas flagged was around commissioned work. The clause currently provides that if there is no contract governing the relationship, the person who commissions is the owner of the copyright, and then the author has a license to do anything with the work that the copyright owner may do. As the DTI, we are proposing the Canadian model, that is to support the DAC proposal where the author owns. So the difference here is that we, with what we had in the bill, we were saying who commissions owns. And the DAC proposed that we need to relook at this to favor the author than the one who pays, who is the commissioner. And we also found that the Dutch copyright law also follows the similar model as the Canadian. And we wanted to also highlight that during the hearings, the big role players, the broadcasters, and other big companies were opposed to the author having a bigger view, I mean, having more rights than the commissioner. So there is a contestation around this area. As the DTI, we propose that we can have this in the bill currently, and limited to particular copyright works. And we support the view of the DAC, and we wanted to clarify our position around this, because it's an area that the committee still needs to finalize on. And the next one,
Honourable Kichazi.
Chair, firstly, it says that the clause currently provides that there is no contract governing the relationship. Now, that doesn't refer to a written contract or oral contract. That has to be clear, because there can be, these are both contracts enforceable in law. So there's no clarity on that. Now, and on what I'm interested to...
Charlie, will you lift your mic?
I'm interested to understand, moreover, that what's the rationale? You state that the Dutch copyright law or the Canadian copyright law proposes, but what's the rationale that says that if there is no contract, question mark, written or oral, as to why the owner and the author should have a skewed right in this area. I'm keen to understand that before we can comment on it, because it's not clear here. It's not.
Get that clarification. Who do you want to? Would you address the DDG?
Yeah, well, on my question, I'm not related to it.
Did you have your hand up? All right.
Thank you. Maybe it was out of your left eye. I'm not sure. And I know you have a challenge there. I just think that what we always need to be very wary of is when we're creating legislation. So we're not creating legislation that becomes a stumbling block to people, expressing their creativeness. And this point bothers me because I often go up to the Midlands in KZN, and if one goes through the Midlands meander, you stop on the side of the road and there are people that are carving lovely animals and so on and so forth. And if I stopped on the side of the road and said, I like the elephant that you've done, but I want something like that, but with one or two things like that. Now, if I don't have a contract on me, and I'm commissioning them to do a creative work for me, they will then own that which I have asked them to create for me, which is truly bizarre. It's completely impractical. And I really think that this hasn't been thought through. I think that the people who are going to be the most affected by this are actually small-scale people that are doing creative beadworks and so on and so forth, in the very informal economy that we have. And in fact, it's actually going to disincentivize people to actually engage with them. But what it also does is it puts an incredible burden on them to be able to understand and be able to have someone to vet a contract if I happen to have a contract in my car as I was driving through the Midlands on my holiday. Who's going to sit down with them and go through that contract if that was the case? So, I think that in the case of commissioned work that is not governed by a contract, I think that this is very prescriptive. I think that it is very damaging to small scale artists that exist in these sort of creative towns, and I really think that there needs to be more thought given to this.
All right, no point made. I just wanted clarity, and perhaps you can provide that as you are addressing the two issues that have arisen. On page 18, I think that's exactly where we are. The explanation is the person, if there's no contract, the person who commissions is the copyright owner. But the author, that's as I understand it, the person who's done the carving in this instance, has a license to do anything with the work that the copyright owner may do. Now, when it says that, it implies, well, if the person who commissions did it and wants to put it somewhere in their house or in a company, the originator can actually copy that. Copy the same thing, same elephant done differently, if you like, and sell it to someone new because they may do exactly what the copyright owner can do. Could you just clarify that as you respond to the two issues?
Thank you, Chair. The intention of this, what we are saying here, is that we want to ensure that the author or the creator also has a say in terms of the creative expression or the creative work that is completed, and we also are recognizing the importance of the contract in terms of their relationship on the creative work itself. I think the point that Honorable McPherson is making, that this area has not been sufficiently thought of, there are still things that one needs to consider, like the situation that he has highlighted. That is an important point, and those are some of the things that will need to be thought of in terms of the actual implementation. But the position here in terms of the policy, what we are saying is that the bill the bill was talking to the, when you commission the work, you own the work, and you have a bigger say in terms of what happens to that work. And then with the model that we are talking to of the Canadian, it gives more rights to the author. So this is the principle that this provision is trying to say. But I would request my colleagues to just come in, maybe Ms. Hendry, and also the DAC, because they also spoke to the model to just to substantiate in terms of where they were coming from. She can start first, and Mr. Mbiba can come in.
Thank you. I'd just like to draw attention to the actual clause, page 27, at the bottom, 22. I note Honourable McPherson's very pertinent point. I just want to, the informal economy won't necessarily be covered. And that's the suggestion or the proposal I made yesterday. It's very specific in terms of what the Commission is referring to. It's the drawing of a portrait, the making of a gravure, the making of an audiovisual work or a sound recording. So the Commission is only applicable to those works as mentioned there, and not necessarily the craft work, because the craft work doesn't appear. So it's a limited application to the works. And that's why I said yesterday, in the light of the uncomfortableness of, you know, like personal, your portrait, maybe let's look at the target is the big corporations that are perhaps abusing this section. Let's focus on the commercial works, being the audiovisual forms and the sound recordings, and look at how we can, you know, cap ourselves in to protect you from your personal point of view, but also that this section isn't hurting the person who is selling crafts and beads, because it's a transaction. You're going to buy something, you're going to make a minor adaptation to his work. You don't need a contract for that. But I think it's nice that you've noted that, but I just want it's very limited in what the Commission applies to.
No, that's helping us come through. I'd like you to come in after we've heard DAC, Honourable Kacharya. Yes, Mr. McBeaver.
Thank you, Chairperson. Firstly, let me indicate that copyright on its own do not protect the idea. If we've got an idea to do something, we don't protect it, but it protects the expression. And in this case, we're talking about who is doing the expression. And that is why we're referring to the creator. So it should be the creator who is actually being protected in this case. But secondly, the question of power dynamics in the cultural and creative industries have shown us that those who've got more money, who can actually commission the work, they have exploited, you know, the situation to an extent that even if they reuse the work beyond the purpose that was commissioned for, they are not looking into compensating the creators. It is for that reason that we then proposing that we need to look into other models. The Canadian model, which is for us, will be enable us to protect our creators in cases where works are being reused for other purposes, and they will be able to benefit from the reuse, and this will assist us also to move people, especially artists, out of destitute position.
Look, I think that's certainly helping us. Reach a better understanding. You had your hand up, Honourable Kacharya, and then let me get the Honourable Khadebe.
I did. It's my understanding that this is, as I said, it's talking to when no contract exists. Right? Now, I asked, it hasn't been answered, whether we're referring to a verbal contract as well as a written contract. secondly, in the instance of a contract, verbal or written, any additional purpose or qualifications to that contract are recorded, either verbally or they're recorded in writing. So that's governed by contract. I say, here, you make this film. You say, but if you use it for this purpose and this purpose, I want sixpence, I want shilling for that. So that's governed by contract, finish and clear. However, in the absence of contract, and I raise the question because everything is governed by contract, if I ask you to paint a picture of me, and there's a contract in existence if you perform on that and give me the picture. Now, if you say that there's no contract, I want to understand under what basis, which is why I raise the question of verbal and written, under what basis a contract doesn't exist in the first instance. In the second instance, it's my view that the contract does exist, so it's, the other point is moot. But if you say there's no contract, that I just, or no written contract, then I've purchased something from you which I believe is contractual because there's performance. Then it's mine. I have the right to that portrait. As I stated before, I could say, goodness, you've made me look very ugly. I'm going to burn this thing. I'm going to burn this thing. So I can do that. You can say, no, don't burn it because I may want to have some access to it later on. And I say, sorry, that's not possible. It's mine. I paid for it, and I'm going to use it. Now, we are not addressing these things. I also asked for I'm giving you the rationale, the counter-rationale. I asked for the rationale behind the Dutch and the Canadian models. I've not heard the rationale. I've just said that the models exist. Well, it's not good enough. I need to hear.
Right. Now, I hear what you're saying, Honorable Khadebe.
Chairperson, I think that the argument provided by DAC and the department are convincing. In particular, when coming to the issue that the personal stuff that the portraits we spoke about, they are not covered by this name. It's understandable. But as I raised yesterday, that when something coming to personal name, it cannot even if you can commission her portrait through me, but it remains hers because it's hers, it's private. I think that the deputy director has said that, has agreed on that. But let's go now to the issue like Stumo. When we had the African Nations Cup in 1996, SAFA commissioned him to do a song for that. It was Shebeleza, that song. He was commissioned, he did the song, but it is him who performed it. So there I agree that the rights must be more with him than SAFA. It was more with him than Safa. Because the one who performed that work. But Chair, the issue again here, we speak about when there's no contract. It would be very wrong to go to such a huge work without putting a contract into place. So if they don't put it into place, then the author must be automatically protected.
But the thing is, as I understand it, this is looking almost at a contingency eventuality. The ideal would be to have a written contract. That's the ideal. But if there isn't one, what would prevail? And I think that's the question it's asking. And the Honourable MacPherson took it down to what many of us are familiar with, purchasing some model off the road, and that we all do that. But you say, no, but I don't want the trunk up, I want it down, or whatever. And that's it. You're not contracting per se, and yet arguably the very fact that you have asked for this to be changed is a contract, you know. Please change this to that. There is it. But I just raise this in passing, Honourable Buyani.
Chair, thank you. I think in the absence of the contract, the law must take its course. And it's clear in the ownership of copyright, the subject or provision of the section, or the principal act, section 21, the ownership of copyright, it is clear on that one. In the absence of any contract that we made, the law is taking its course and it's clear in terms of the ownership. I don't know why we need to go to any model. But she also in this clause number 21, the very same page 18.
Yeah.
I'm not so sure because even the DN, the DAC, they say they still need clarity on this one. And also it was said the proposals they were made, the mod is coming from the DAC. And also the DAC currently, they say they need more induction on the model. So I think, to me, my understanding is contrary to what is reflecting on the document. Thanks, Chair.
Honourable Chiaka, thank you, Honourable Buyani.
I think I'm becoming confused, yeah. I'm more confused with all the explanation that is taking place here. But however, I think here we need more information on this one. Just for the department, DAC and the DTI, together with our advocate, they must just go and do the reference, not concentrating only on Canadian. We need more research on this one so that at least we are informed better. And the last, I think yesterday we spoke about the policy issues. Policy, yeah, I think there are, that the department must tell us if we are moving away, the position of the policy. So I think we need also that information that will make sure that this, we are not causing more harm than it is. So I wanted us to propose that we flag it, maybe by tomorrow, because I don't think it's a big issue. Tomorrow we'll have a detailed information so that we take an informed decision, all of us.
Before we get any more hands, or take any more hands into up, one needs to remind all, myself and everyone, South Africa works on Roman Dutch law, and a contract is either verbal or written. You don't have to use the words, I contract you to do X. The mere fact that I ask you to please, that's the table I want, but I want you to raise it, or I want you to put four legs in. But that's basically it. I ask you to do that for me. We don't sign anything. In South African law, that's a contract. It's a verbal contract. So, you know, I saw this as being a very rare position where there would be no contract at all, because if on the other, because it's using the word commission. If you commission someone, you're asking someone to do something. And that is a contract under Roman Dutch law. You see, so that I was getting, you know, that I can tell you from long experience with legislation, it's been clear to me that we have the toughest contract law internationally. And this is a contract, whether verbal, it's not written, and maybe what may have been meant, well, not meant, but what could perhaps be taken into account if there is not a written contract, what prevails. Because verbal contracts are verbal contracts. Full stop. The mere saying, I commission, you don't even have to use the word commission. You just say, please, I want you to do this like that. That's a contract. So I think that we must do what the Honourable Tierko has proposed, and that is to ask the DTI and also DAC to take that into account, what I've said, and to see how best to word it here. Because I can assure you the Canadian model is not, you don't have contract, Roman Dutch law contract there. I know they don't, and neither does Dutch. As we're calling it Roman Dutch law, the Dutch moved away a long time. We didn't.
Chair, if you will allow me, I just wanted to, I heard the resolution agent from Honorable Teko, but I would like to just try to clarify just one last time. On page 28 of the draft 2 bill, if you go to where it says provided, page 28 of the bill, okay, I'm going to start on provided. It says, provided that in the absence of a valid contract, ownership shall vest in the person commissioning the work, and the author of the work shall have a license to exercise any right which by virtue of this act would otherwise be exercisable exclusively by the owner. So what we are saying, we are looking at that clause, and we are saying that we then want to give, instead of the ownership vesting on the person who commissions, we want to vest that on the author or the creator of the work. It's just more empowering the author than the way that it is currently exercised in the bill. So it was just to give that clarity. And my two colleagues from CIPC wanted to say something, just to give a context. So I'll start with Mr. Beje and then Mr. Matsimbi.
Thank you. Good idea.
Thank you, Chair. Maybe, yes, maybe let me just share with the House some of the challenges that led to the sector not favoring the commission to work, so that we can have an idea as to why they criticized it. It's unfortunate that we have SABC, which is a user and also an owner of content at a particular point in time. And that's what confuses the system sometimes, because they are able to commission the work, but they are also able to consume it on their platforms. Now, sometimes you find a situation whereby they commission people to produce a particular work. It could be Soapies or something else. Then, through time, they shelve the work.
Yeah.
That work is no longer going to be commercialized because SABC doesn't want to use it. Whether it's a good work or not a good work is something else, but it remains in the shelves. Now, the author who has created that work is not given an opportunity to commercialize the work, even if it's shelved by the person who commissioned it. That is a challenge.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing that I want to flag is that in terms of South African law, if I live in Pretoria, I go to a taxi rank and I get into a taxi rank to Mamelodi, I have a contract with that driver that you will take me to Mamelodi and I will pay you. It doesn't have to be in writing, as long as the statute doesn't say it must be in writing. But it's a contract. So the word commissioning is a contract itself. As long as the statute doesn't say it must be in writing, it will remain valid. So if you can look at Section 21, those provisions are deeming statements, are deeming provisions. They are just saying whoever commissions the work and agrees to pay it is the owner, unless there is contrary to it. So I just thought I could just share with the committee so that as we discuss this thing, we're able to understand where it comes from and what does it try to achieve at the end.
Is helping us, especially the issue about a work being shelved, and yet you still want the owner or originator to use it. Yes, let's move on to...
Thank you. I will not say too much because my colleague has already said a mouthful. Yes, ma'am. Basically, when you're reading that statement, it says the governing of the relationship. Sometimes you have to take into consideration the business aspect of it, where the author can bargain by saying, I will not even use my rights to have the license to do certain acts. So they can trade on that basis. But the provision itself, it creates a compulsory license that is given to the author, so that the author is in a position to do the work, to do the act in conjunction with the work, without him being the owner. Remember, ownership is a real right. The owner has all the rights to the work itself. However, where there is a situation where these two parties want to agree that I am going to have a monopoly over this work, can we agree? But in the absence of that agreement, then there is a compulsory license that is given to the author. I don't know if it's clear. It's some sort of a bargaining power where there is no agreement that, you know, this is how we are going to deal with this work. Say, for an example, I'm commissioned to do the work, but the person who's commissioning me wants to monopolize that work, wants to be the only person who provides that work. They can agree that, okay, in that case, I will, as an author, I will not even do anything. But if the agreement is not there, the statute gives the author that compulsory license to do certain acts with the work.
You're talking about an automatic right. The moment that transaction is conducted, there's an automatic right given to the originator, whatever, in this case. Notwithstanding that it was commissioned by someone else. Right. Honourable Kachalia, try to keep it brief, please.
Yes, dear. I think we need a legal opinion on this. I'm not sure that this will pass muster. As the chair said quite clearly, in our law, a contract exists if there's offer and acceptance. Everyone knows that. That constitutes a contract. When offer and acceptance both simultaneously exist, ownership passes to the person who pays the money for something of value. That constitutes a contract. It belongs to me if I were the person who made the offer. Now I then own that. If you turn around and say that in the absence, you can, written contracts can vary this any which way but loose. You can make a gift, you can do anything you want to, but you can make it so punitive to say on the person who's purchasing it, say you can only use it for this purpose. But if in the absence of a written contract, where there is a verbal contract where offer and acceptance exists, it is my contention that that lies, that the ownership vests then with the person who is paid for it. And if you seek to vary that by some sort of deemed provision which skews it in favor of the originator, no matter how morally right you may see this, I think you'll find yourself in great conflict with the law. But I'd like that to be tested. Thank you.
I do hear you. And I think we may have to consider flagging this for the moment. It's delaying us a fair amount of time. But I just wondered, you know, this whole word commissioning, when authors write a book or write anything, write poetry or whatever, it's your work. You've got the copyright. But it sells so well, the publisher says, come on, please produce another one. That's a contract. Who owns it then? And I can see challenges arising unless we clarify this in the Act. Because then the publisher has commissioned it. So under one side of the argument, then they own it. They've got the copyright in that. But I'm saying, no, I produced it. It's mine. So I would like the legal minds here, plus CIP, to apply their minds to this. I don't think it is as simple as it looks, given our legal framework in South Africa. I really do mean that. I'm not saying we can't achieve it, but I'm saying we want to ensure that we produce a robust piece of legislation that protects the originator. That's the purpose. All right? So please, I'm asking all legal minds here apply themselves, as will the DTI and the committee. Let's park it. Think about it overnight. We may have a brainwave, any one of us, you know? and then come back tomorrow. And if we don't succeed, we may have to get some other opinion. All right. Can we agree on that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm out there, sir. All right, let's move.
On Clause 23, Section 22, regarding the assignment and licensing in respect of copyright, on this one, it talks about the assignment of assignments of rights up to 25 years, and we are just clarifying whom the assignment refers to. So we want composers and publishers to recover economic benefits from the assigned copyright works, and we want to limit the applications of this clause to composers and publishers, and also to say that the life of the contract must not exceed the assignment period. So this one is just to clarify that for certainty.
We had this discussion yesterday, and I was under the impression we had exhausted it, you know, but I'm looking here at members because we were saying, look, as I understood it, that if you've taken this, if I've agreed to something, you know, that you can have this, I don't know what you'd call it, copyright or whatever, it shouldn't be for more than 25 years, and then if you like, you can sign another contract, can I put it that way? And we said, no, it should not be up to 50 years. You should have the opportunity of having it back, having the copyright returned to you. You often see this in records, you know, that people produce, that they're so desperate to get it published or to get it made or whatever that's called, that they agree, contractors, 25 years, because someone says this is the sound we want, and it booms. And then thereafter, everything belongs. So that contract shouldn't extend for longer than 25 years at a time before renewal, as I understand it. You can renew it. Is that right?
Yes, Chair. The intention for this was just to add the composers and the publishers to it so that it's not too wide, it's limited to them. It's for more clarity. So it's something that needs to be inserted in that specific clause.
It's limiting the application to composers and publishers only, as I understand it. That's and full agreement.
Thank you, Chair. Clause 24, Section 22A, assignment and licenses in respect of orphan works. We ended the debate around the orphan works. It was one of the areas flagged, and then one of the issues here was the process of identifying orphan works in the bill, and we were saying that it's cumbersome, and it was awaiting clarity on the fair use, fair dealing finalization. And we are proposing that the hybrid model of the fair use doctrine will be used, and orphan works can be used without permission of the author. So with the hybrid model, we are saying that the orphan works can be used without the permission of the author, and that the author, and we agree that the author must have access to the work immediately when they resurface. So the author does not have to wait for a period of time. Immediately once they are identified, they can have access to their work and their royalties.
Right, members, I thought in principle we had agreed here again, but was there a call for you to flesh it out, perhaps?
We are raising it because of the hybrid, to say even the hybrid model addresses the cumbersome process.
On the orphan works was whether clause 24, section 22A, should in fact remain in the bill, or whether it is sufficiently covered under our hybrid model. And I don't see that being addressed, and that is quite relevant for drafting purposes.
Yeah, if we go to our matrix, you'll see exactly that issue being raised and some of the notes that you would have made yesterday on this. Clause 24, section 22A, is that right? Do they sufficiently apply? Because I'm noting here assignment and licenses in respect of that. And we said maybe contained under hybrid. So there was a need for us to fashion a clause, and the clause that you are fashioning would look like what? Because that's what I've written here.
Chair, thank you, and thank you, Advocate. We are proposing that it remains, and that with the hybrid model it will be covered, but we can look at then how then does the clause, how is the clause supposed to look like with that context. We can look at that and come back.
The DTI is saying that they will draft or craft something to that end. All right. Also looking at the advocate here, and CRPC and everyone. Yeah. Okay. Then let's move on. That's coming back. Right. Flagged.
And Chair, now we are moving to the collecting societies. There is a yesterday.
In respect of 2024, clause 24, section 22A, it says by initiating legal action to recover such royalties, that is, royalties going forward, not retrospectively, as I would understand it. That's good.
You're saying you, 22A, a person who wishes to obtain a license, is that what you're reading?
No, I'm reading here, the copyright owner may at any time collect the royalties fixed in the license or in default of payment by initiating legal action to recover such royalties. And then it goes on to say any person who can adduce evidence for the purpose of proof. So my understanding is that there's an orphan work, people are using it because it's allowed to be used. The owner surfaces and says and produces evidence to say this is my work. Then from then onwards they're entitled to it. They can't go back saying because you used it, I'm entitled. I want to be clear on that. Because we need to be clarity, and there's no clarity in the way it's drafted.
All right. The question that arises, how did it become an orphan work? That's the first thing I would ask, and then because we had to protect the vulnerable. I don't know what thoughts other members have got here. Honourable Pichania?
I mean, it could be an estate. The person could well have died, and the estate now has a claim. So, and as such, the state says, oh, hold on, that's my dad's work. And I, so.
No, but you see, there are, you've even come up with a practical example yourself, you know. Honourable Kadevi, did you have a hand up?
Yes, sir.
I think on that fuller regard, the issue of retrospectivity is very important.
Yeah,
or a chair, the issue of retrospectivity is very important. Their work might be often work. They might not be known, the people behind that work. But on the day that work is being used, if that person is making money out of that, he must know that he was using someone else's work. So if the person can claim that, it must be done. That's what happened with this issue of Timbube in the Lion King. They said that they didn't know. But the estate of those people claimed that, and then they got their money back.
I do remember when the Lion treat, you know, at one stage, you will recall, Honourable Kachalia, this committee raised the issue of, you know, can this be made retrospective? And I think the advocate was saying, well, no, you can't go back forever in time on this issue. But I think what I would want to ask the advocate is it possible legally to make something retrospective by, say, 5 years or something, or what? Or not at all legally?
Firstly, it is possible to make things retrospective for as long as we want. The question is whether it's practical. But this specific clause, I do not think that retrospectivity is a concern. Because what this clause does is it creates a fund, it creates a mechanism for royalties to be paid, which we don't have at the moment. So at the moment, you would have to try and find the person who used your work. So let's say my work was out in the public, didn't really bother with it, it's fine. The person who wants to now use my work doesn't know that I'm the actual copyright owner. He uses the work, I go to a movie and I'm like, oh, there's my work. Now, what currently I would have to do is to trace whoever made the movie and then claim from them, as the example was from Mr. Hadevi. The thing that we're creating here is to say that if you want to use this work, we're putting steps in place now. You need to go through certain steps to try and find out who the work belongs to. Then you can ask for a license to use the work. So once you have that license to use the work, you will pay a royalty into a fund. So the answer to Mr. Kachalia's question is, so the money is paid into a fund. Now, so my example, I saw my work in a movie. We now passed that this amendment bill is actually enacted. Now, instead of me having to go to the finding the movie producer, I just go to the fund and say, well, did this person pay, and I need that, and then for going forward, now I'm telling the producer, you need to pay me whenever this thing is screened, I need to get some royalties.
Committee nodding. I'm looking on my left now. Yes, Jack, Mr. Mbiva.
Chairperson, thank you. Just wanted to clarify the question of often work. And to my understanding is that often work is subject to protection. And in many instances, often work will, whoever wants to use often work will get license from the collecting societies and they will pay for that. The issue here is how do then the collecting societies distribute the income accrued from the often work. There's a section in this bill that proposes that money should go to a trust account for a period of about 5 years. And we raised a concern as DAC to say, what will then happen after the 5 years? How do we then use the money? Because it cannot just sit within the trust account after the expiry of the 5 years. My understanding is that this clause, yes, is something that we can support, but we need to understand that the money will be taken into the trust account should that person be identified. Therefore, it's no longer going to be classified as often work because we have identified the owner. But the question of the 5 years period, it's something that still needs to be clarified as to how is that money going to be used? And we made a proposal that perhaps maybe it can be redirected for redistribution and a portion of it be used for cultural development.
Right. That was the proposal from DAC, right? Let's go across to Mr. Pecci.
Yeah, just to share with the committee how United Kingdom has approached the whole thing of Orphanworks. What they did, because the country is the owner, the state becomes the owner. Anyone who wants to use the work is licensed by the state. Then they will put the whole money in a fund for a certain period. If we opt for 5 years, it will be 5 years. If we opt for 3 years, it will be 3 years. Then if the owner cannot be traced during that period, then it gets forfeited to the state. But should the owner come to the fore during that period, he's allowed to claim because the money is there. But you need to build a collection mechanism so that the work can be licensed and royalty can be collected. So you cannot just put provisions without a collection mechanism in it.
I'm looking around. I think we agree with that. Are we still agreed on 5 years? Because I think that's what's here, is it? Advocate?
What does the
Advocate van der Merwe is just coming in.
Sorry.
Sorry, Chair. We must just be cautious of the five-year period, because what we had in the bill was that we had a period of 5 years, so that if you, the copyright owner may not later than 5 years after the expiration of the license collect the royalties. The concern is that that is expropriation. If the copyright owner surfaces 10 years later, they still have a claim on that money. On what basis are we expropriating? So we differ a bit from you, Vane, that we have a constitution that has that property right, which is not the case in the UK. So that is a bit of a concern. It means that we can't just say the money forfeits to the state. It is not to say that the money cannot be used, but the state will have to be a guarantor for whatever money is used. So it could perhaps be used as investment, things like that, in respect of arts and culture. But at any time that the owner surfaces, they will have to be able to claim that money.
Yeah. If you think of the lion, I mean, they didn't surface for a long time, you know, when the lion feeds. No, I'm just saying certain realities. So thank you for reminding us of that legal, our constitution yet again, which again makes us so unique. Let's move on, because I think there is the protection.
I'm covered by what the advocate has said is what I want to raise.
No, thank you very much. We're moving on. Thank you. DDG.
Thank you, Chair. On the, we are moving to the collecting societies, and on the collecting societies, I wanted to, we reviewed the list that we have circulated earlier to Parliament on the collecting societies, and we thought that we can just update that list and provide more information. So currently, we have five collecting societies in South Africa. One of them is an association, but it collects for recording companies. There are collecting societies that are not under CIPC regulatory framework, and that is they're not credited by our entity CIPC, and that is SAMRO CAPASO. SAMRO administers Section 6 rights, which deals with music compositions. This is a self-regulating agency, and it is only accountable to its members, and these are right holders and composers. And SAMRO has a wing called DALRO, and which administers authors' rights in literary works. And then we have CAPASO. CAPASO administers reproduction rights, which emanates from both Section 6 and 9 rights in the regulations. CAPAFO is also a self-regulating agency and also accountable to its members. The collecting societies that are currently under the CIPC regulatory framework are SAMPRA and IMPRA. These are under Section 9, and they are known as needle time rights, and they are also under CIPC supervision. And SARAL and NOM are no longer in existence. NOM merged with CAPASO. SARAL was liquidated. POSA was never a collecting society, but just a wing within SAMRO, responsible for needle time rights administration. And POSA merged with SAMPRA. And as I've indicated, RISA is an association of recording companies. The reason why I thought to bring this picture is just for members to understand when we talk about collecting societies, who they are and what rights they administer, so that when we say collecting societies for needle time, you have a sense of who they are, and those that are in the market but are not regulated, but self-regulated. So this is the current picture. So we reviewed that list. So the original list, we can just focus on this one.
I just wish to remind members, this was distributed yesterday. We've all got it, and we start a reference to the collecting agencies from 193. And it gives you the full background there of what they gave us during the public hearings. So that will prove quite useful to all of us. Honourable MacPherson?
Thank you. DDG, you know, I've been giving this thought about log sheets. I've been giving the idea of log sheets quite a bit of thought and how they relate to collecting societies and people who play the music. And unless those sheets are actually filled in, you may not know that the song was actually played and then a royalty is not played. Now, in the corporate sector, specifically with regards to some of the bigger shopping centres in South Africa, how they work is they charge a sort of a base rent or a flat rent, and then they then charge a percentage on turnover. And how they know what the turnover per store is because they have access to the electronic till system that exists in each store. So it's not even for the store to tell them what their turnover was, but centre management know what their turnover is because it tells them every month, it was 1 million or 10 million, whatever, and then their percentage is based on that. Surely what we should be looking to do if we really wanted to protect creators, specifically in the music industry, there should be an ability for CIPC to be able to look into what the electronic music log is for each station once a month to be able to determine who has played what and what is owed. Instead of this other system of waiting for them to tell you. And surely that creates a fairer system and in fact a less administrative system for radio stations or people playing music to then have to, spend hours trying to work out who played what when for how long and how many times per day. I know that that may not be applicable right now, but I think it's something certainly to look to for the future to streamline the system. And I always say, Chair, with respect, is that there are always great things that are done in the private sector that I think that we should be able to adapt and use when it comes to issues like this. And I think that the way that, centre management and stores, share information on profit or on turnover to determine rentals is something that can be mirrored in this particular industry.
Thank you for that addition, because I think you may have just not been here when we dealt with log sheets yesterday. Or were you?
No.
Are you? But this is in addition to collecting, that's why I say. That's worth a thought, some of the information that we've just heard as to how we can, can it be of any help here? If so, how would it be used constructively? So please keep that in mind so that, again, you would be able to comment on that tomorrow. All right? So would you like to continue then, Mr. Pechu?
No.
Oh, sorry, Honorable Biani.
Yeah, and Chair. I think none of these collecting societies are regulated by government, the CIPC. None of them. All of them, they are self-regulatory, but most of they are collecting money, they are not registered with government or any CIPC. For an example, some owned and controlled by some. And the composer Capas set up and controlled by some. And now the MD of SAM, which was former Capas member. Chairperson, the RISA and the South African SAMPRA, it's one of the very same, in fact, it's one organization. They even sharing, some of them renting one place, all of the companies. So to us coming here and telling us, we are in parliament here, and we are representing the masses. We cannot have one conglomerate operating the entire SNR like the CIPC. It's not even the government. No one knows about them. Where are they from? How many members they have? So we cannot just pass this one without clarity.
Thank you very much. Where is this input we've just had? I was concerned when I heard that in some row is self-regulating and then various others were self-regulating and therefore they weren't registered with CIPC. And I think when it comes to the protection of artists, etc., and when I say artists, I'm talking broadly now, writers, singers, etc. If we're going to protect them, how can we protect them if they are not registered at all? Not registered, they're self-regulating. And perhaps by being self-regulating, they can argue that like a club, a membership as a private membership here. You know, we will, our members have agreed to this. Now, I don't know if you know, I think that members should consider the issue, do we want to allow, that's the one view, self-regulating agents, that's the one. On the other, do we believe there would be more protection for the artists broadly speaking, if all of the agencies were registered? I think that's... and what I'm going to ask members to do is over tea to consider that and then come back. If we just sort of 5, 6, 7 minutes, we can start at 20 past. All right? I don't see a clock here, but my watch is about 10 past now, 10 past 3.
I'm thinking I'm going to need the electronic copy. I'll copy to that one now. That would be like tomorrow. Yeah. Now you do.
I'm going to charge my phone in the office.
You want to charge your phone?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Actually, that applies to all of us.
That's why I'm sitting next to her.
Some people have got power. This thing gets older.
Yeah.
The power goes faster.
Okay, I'll speak to you then when you come back.
Okay, I'm coming.
I need to ask.
It's the actual tea.
I hope so. Yesterday it wasn't. You know, I was so tired yesterday. And the reason I need to charge is because I left my recording in the rat bill. Yes. But then I asked the chairperson of our conference, like, when you are done, give me a call. And then I see that my battery is dying. So I was like, no, it's because they're going until half past.
I was so tired. I did some work, but I think I'm okay.